3. The drive from the airport to downtown Chicago was like a weird dream from childhood. I'd seen the buildings and landmarks a thousand times before, but my memories had fuzzed around the edges like feathering ink. The city had changed as I'd grown up, as supernatural tourism and creativity pumped money into the economy. The river nymphs had become fashion designers, and they'd made their eponymous headquarters in a gleaming gold building near Merchandise Mart that was nearly as large. The fairies, whose population had boomed after an evil sorceress spread magic through the city, turned a run-down block in South Loop into an undulating park with their new home, which was more castle than mansion. The human parts of the city had changed, too. The newest buildings were topped by living roofs of plants and trees, and were dotted with wind power funnels. Solar panels were mounted on cars, warehouses, and billboards with the city's Zero Waste motto. But some things hadn't changed at all. Even with autos, traffic was snarled before we reached downtown. We headed east toward Michigan Avenue, passing the spot where that evil sorceress had tried to destroy Chicago. My grandfather, Joshua Merritt, had owned the building where she'd made her stand, and it had been torn apart in the battle with her. It hadn't fared any better in the second round, but the architect probably hadn't planned for a dragon attack. Since my grandfather would have given Scrooge McDuck a run for his money, he'd tried to rebuild. But no one wanted to invest money in what had been a lightning rod for magic. So he'd pulled down the building's shell, sold the scrap, and donated the land to the city. Now there was a pretty plaza where tourists and buskers gathered when the weather was warm. The Portman Grand was just off state, a column of pale stone, with symmetrical windows and flags flying above the entrance. A crowd of humans had gathered to watch the autos arrive, the sidewalk crowded with people who waved their screens in the air, waiting for a glimpse of vampires. There were Cadogan House caps sprinkled in with the usual Cubs, Sox, Hawks, and Bears gear, and a few Welcome to Chicago signs that made me feel better after yesterday's attack. Peace was never guaranteed, but it was good to see allies in the crowd. They screamed my name when I climbed out of the car. My parents were the closest thing American supernaturals had to royalty. That, and my unusual biology, made the media particularly interested in me. The attention had always made me uncomfortable, not least because I hadn't done anything to deserve it. But I waved and smiled as I followed Sari toward the door, letting the bellman handle the luggage so I could get inside faster. And I didn't fail to notice the men and women in severe black suits positioned near the door. Security personnel keeping an eye on things. I relaxed incrementally. Inside, the hotel looked European. Cool and quietly luxurious, with gorgeous art, lush fabrics, and soft golden light that left plenty of shadows for the wealthy and famous to lounge and whisper in and remain undisturbed.
Elisa Sullivan!
I turned, found a man with brown skin and short black hair in twisted whorls. He was cute, with hazel eyes and a wide, generous mouth quirked in a crooked smile. Easily 4 or 5 inches over 6 feet, and fit for his height. His fashion sense was also quirky, if the bow tie and Converses he'd paired with the dark gray suit were any indication. A black canvas messenger bag was situated diagonally across his chest. "That's me," I said, and took the hand he offered.
"Theo Martin. I'm one of the assistant ombudsmen."
"There are assistant ombudsmen?" He smiled endearingly.
"There are."
His gaze shifted and he smiled at Sari. "Seraphine of Maison Dumas," I said when she reached us. "Theo Martin." "A pleasure," she said. Theo pulled a packet from his bag, offered it to me.
Your badges, itineraries, maps, security information.
Sari and I took them.
The other delegates from France have arrived?
They have, he said. They were escorted to their rooms on the secured floors. We've stationed security at the elevators and stairs and throughout the building.
Thank you, I said. Any trouble?
None,
Theo said, and his smile dropped away.
We heard about Paris, but we've had no concerns here. Hopefully it will stay that way. And if not,
he lifted a shoulder.
That's why we're here.
By we, he meant the Ombudsman's office. My parents had had plenty of adventure before peace came to Chicago. They'd battled monsters, demons, sorcerers, and elves, among others. But while they'd saved the city several times over, those adventures, and the evildoers they'd battled, had damaged city property. Just after I was born, they struck a deal with the mayor. In the future, they'd let the Ombudsman's office handle the supernatural drama. In exchange, the damages to city property would be forgiven, and the Ombudsman got a bigger office, a bigger budget, and a bigger staff. Theo's smile was still easy, so I didn't think he meant the comment as a rebuke. Just a promise to help.
Sure, I said with a non-committal smile. And thanks for the packet.
Enjoy your room, he said. And we'll see you at the party.
Unless I fell into the minibar first. I distributed the room keys and badges to Sari and her entourage and saw them to their rooms. We passed a half-dozen guards on the way, which made me relax a little more. They'd given me a suite with an amazing view of Grant Park and Lake Michigan. It was styled much like the lobby, but with Chicago flair. Expensive fabrics in pale gold and deep turquoise were paired with large, stark photographs of Chicago architecture. The Nautilus staircase in the Rookery building, the stair step silhouette of Willis Tower, the lions in front of the Art Institute. My suitcase was waiting and already propped on a stand. I stuffed clothes into drawers and toiletries into the bath, then hung up the fancier things I didn't want to have to iron over the next few nights. I traveled in jeans and layers for the inevitable chill on the plane. The reception was semi-formal, but still work, and it would require something more dramatic. I'd learned early how clothes helped make the vampire, and that had only been reinforced in Paris. I'd brought a black cocktail dress, a simple column with a hem that ended just above the knees and long, fluid sleeves, and I paired it with black stilettos. Not practical for fighting, assuming that would happen at a supernatural reception, but they were kicked off easily enough. I left my hair down, gave myself a quick makeup check, and added blush to cheeks made extra pale by travel and mascara to green eyes that needed a pick-me-up. After the party, I'd come back to the room, rehydrate, and try to squeeze in a few yoga poses. I'd started doing yoga as a teenager because the stretches made painful vampiric growth spurts a little easier to bear, and I'd kept up the practice. I liked being flexible. But, most important, I liked being in control. Yoga gave me the focus I needed to stay that way. When I focused, I wasn't Elisa and Monster. I simply was. I decided to leave my katana in the room, but I slipped a small knife into my clutch, just in case. A vampire couldn't be too prepared. Vampires were the only supernaturals officially participating in the talks, but the reception was open to all of Chicago's sups. Both sets, European vampires and Chicago supernaturals, were given the chance to make their own entrance into the party, a chance to show off their particular cultures. It was our version of the Olympic opening ceremony. A wide wooden staircase led from the hotel's opulent lobby to the second floor,
where the Red Ballroom awaited its guests. There were metal detectors and scanners at the entrance, and a coat check for jackets, wraps, bags, and supernatural weapons that weren't allowed into the ballroom. I'd gotten an exception for my knife since I was there, at least in part, to keep an eye on the Dumas vampires. A large man with broad shoulders, a short neck, and pug-nosed face, one of Chicago's river trolls, offered a length of pipe to the young woman who manned the coat check, gum popping and apparently unfazed as she attached a tag to the pipe and handed the troll his receipt.
"Have a good night. Next, please," she said,
the words running together in a well-practiced song. I walked into the ballroom, which was an impressive space. The walls were painted with sweeping murals of Chicago's history, the floor covered in crimson carpet patterned with gold filigree. Strings of tiny lights reached down from the ceiling like stars within reach. There were bars and buffet tables along one wall that smelled enticingly of meat, a string quartet on the dais at the opposite end that played a low concerto, and a long aisle between cocktail tables where the supernatural parade would make its way through the room.
"Hey, Elisa," said a voice I didn't immediately recognize.
I glanced beside me, saw only shoulders. I had to look up to see the face of the assistant ombudsman I'd met earlier today.
"Hey,"
I said with a little wave. "It's Theo, right?"
"That's me."
He still wore the dark suit and bright gingham bow tie.
"I like the tie."
"Thanks. I like the dress," he said,
and gestured to his own arm.
"And the sleeves."
"Thanks," I said with a smile. "Did you get all the delegates checked in?"
"Every last one of them," Theo said. "They're scattered around the city, of course, in the unlikely event anyone should attack. That was a challenge, and not just because of the egos."
"Complainers?" I asked with a smile.
"You have no idea. I won't name names. Spain," he muttered behind a fake cough. "But one delegate was angry about the size of his three-room suite because he'd been promised a four-room suite."
Obviously intentional to humiliate him.
He smiled knowingly.
"Exactly. Another was mad because the mini bar booze wasn't top shelf, and she wasn't going to drink swill."
I walked through my mental list of the European houses, the delegates.
"Germany?" I guessed.
"Nailed it," he said.
My parents walked in, my father in a crisp tuxedo, my mother in a sleeveless black sheath that fell to mid-calf, her hair around her shoulders. They were holding hands, my father whispering something that had my mother grinning. Her response had him rolling his eyes.
"They seem well-matched," Theo said.
"I think they are." I looked at him. "Are you here with someone?"
"Me? No, I'm single."
He smiled, but his brow was furrowed.
"I'm not really looking. Career is first for me. What about you? The media loves to speculate about Cadogan's princess."
"That's just clickbait," I said. "I'm single too, and not really looking either. Ditto the career thing."
"Sounds like we have a lot in common."
I had a feeling he meant exactly that. No more and no less. I hadn't known Theo for longer than an hour, but there was something about him I liked. Something honest and unpretentious. After living with vampires for 23 years, that was a characteristic I could appreciate.
"Yeah," I said. "It sounds like we do."
"Good evening," my father said when they reached us, then bent to kiss my cheek. "You look lovely."
"Thank you. You look very dashing, as always." I gestured to Theo. "Theo, have you met my parents?"
"Hello, Theo," my mother said, holding out a hand. "We met at the barbecue."
"Sure, sure,"
Theo said and shook hands with her, then my father.
Barbecue? I asked. Your great-grandfather's annual event, my mother said. The downside of living in Paris was missing family events. Did he make the red coleslaw? He did, my mother said with a grin, and I sighed balefully. Theo slanted me a look.
That was a pretty serious sigh for coleslaw. I mean, no one actually eats the coleslaw, do they? It's just for show, right?
You obviously didn't try the coleslaw, my mother said, clucking her tongue. Obviously baffled, Theo looked at my father.
But it's coleslaw. What am I missing?
My father slid his hands into his pockets.
I decline the invitation to debate coleslaw again, and I strongly suggest you walk away as well. Debating food with the Merritt family is a war you cannot win.
Theo still looked baffled, but he was smiling, which I figured was just about the correct reaction. The coleslaw was fantastic as always, my mother said, ending the argument. And the pack supplied the meat this year. It was great. You should check out the new office while you're in town. It's impressive. And Lulu's painting a mural at Little Red. She told me, I said. Lulu Bell was my best friend and the daughter of my mother's best friend, Mallory Carmichael Bell. Unlike Mallory, Lulu didn't do magic, but she did art in a big way. She'd taken classes at the Art Institute, led her high school art club, and had gotten a degree from a fancy design school on the East Coast. Now she worked as a freelance painter and illustrator. The bigger the image, the better. Little Red was the PAX bar, situated in a corner of the city's Ukrainian village neighborhood. I let her know I got here safe, and I'm going to try to get over there tomorrow, I said. Is Uncle Malik coming tonight? I looked around again. I'd seen two of Chicago's masters, Morgan Greer and Scott Gray, in the crowd. But the fourth was a no-show so far. Malik had been my father's second-in-command until he'd gotten his own house 3 years ago. Malik and his wife Aaliyah had been the only other married couple in Cadogan House while I'd lived there. My father's siblings were long gone, and we hadn't visited my mother's side of the family very often, so Malik and Aaliyah had been my family.
Not tonight, my father said. He took point on preparations at the theater for the session tomorrow. He's with Yoon and Petra, Theo said, then glanced at me. Roger Yoon's the second in command at the OMB. That's what we call the office. And Petra's our tech lead.
And you got parade duty? My mother asked with a smile.
I wasn't about to miss this, he said. It's the Macy's Thanksgiving Day Parade with fangs and fur. And there's your tagline, my father said with a smile.
Theo frowned and squinted at something in the front of the room. He mumbled something about flags, then offered his excuses and headed through the crowd. I watched until he reached a woman adjusting the flags of the represented nations at the front of the room, then worked with her to adjust their height so they matched perfectly. My father glanced at me.
I don't see Sari or Marion. I presume the French delegation is marching.
They are. I suggested they toss croissant from baskets, but Marion declined. My father's brows lifted in amusement.
You suggested the master of Maison Dumas throw pastries at a crowd of delegates?
It was funny in context, I said, and then wondered if I'd made some sort of international faux pas. But I remembered Marion's throaty chuckle and decided I was in the clear. She actually thought pain au chocolat would be more festive, I explained. I suppose they won't be parading, my mother said, and gestured toward the door. Gabriel Keane, Shifter, and Alpha stood just inside the ballroom, casting a wary gaze on the formal surroundings. His leather jacket and slacks were a contrast to the finery in the room, but his outfit was fancy by shifter standards. At his side was his wife, Tanya. He was as tall and broad-shouldered as Tanya was petite and delicate. He had dark blonde hair, tan skin, golden eyes. She was pale with dark hair, her eyes green and sharp in a way that belied her size. Shifters fell between humans and vampires on the mortality spectrum, getting longer lifespans than humans, but not the full dose of forever. So Gabriel and Tanya hadn't aged as much as humans, or as little as vampires. Time had put soft lines at the corners of their eyes, around their smiles. They looked around, spotted us, and headed our way. And into the space where they'd stood, stepped the Prince of Wolves himself. The last 4 years had been good to Connor Keene. He had his father's build and his mother's coloring. His wavy hair was nearly black, and just long enough to frame his spring blue eyes. He had thick brows, a strong jaw, and a dimple in his square chin. His lips were generous and smiling. His nose was straight, except for a divot on the bridge from a high school fight. He was undeniably gorgeous, but as cocky as they came. Absolutely sure of his place in the world, because he'd decided he'd take his father's position as head of the pack, competitors be damned. And reckless, because he was a shifter. He'd driven me crazy, like an irritating burr. And because our parents were friends, he'd been a burr at Cadogan House entirely too often. He was taller now, his shoulders broader, and the muscle looked good beneath the gray slacks and a gray vest over a white button-down shirt, the sleeves rolled up over strong arms. He held himself differently. There was no teenage slouch, no lanky muscle. There was confidence, power, and awareness. This wasn't the boy who'd stolen my toy sword. This was a man on the edge of power. So I prepared for battle. 4. Connor glanced at me, eyes appraising as he looked me over, and took my measure. Then he strode toward us and joined his parents. "Kitten," Gabriel said to my mother. "Sullivan," to my father, and then he looked at me, smiled. "Elisa, welcome back."
"Thank you. It's good to be home."
"I'm sure you two remember each other," Tanya said, putting a hand on Connor's forearm when he reached us. How could I have forgotten?
"Of course," I said.
"Elisa,"
Connor said my name slowly and deliberately, like he'd never let the word cross his lips, which was entirely possible, since he'd usually called me brat because it drove me crazy. I'd usually called him puppy for the same reason. Maybe we were playing nice.
"How are you?" I asked.
"I'm good. I didn't know you were coming back."
I smiled. "So you didn't dress up for me?" His eyes warmed, a corner of his mouth lifting in a smile that had destroyed plenty of hearts.
"I'm not wearing a cape. Isn't that the vampire uniform?"
Or maybe we weren't playing nice. "Only if it has the high collar," I said, pointing to my neck. "You aren't wearing the uniform of your people either. Leather and motorcycle boots, right?" This was our script of sarcasm, older now than the last time we'd played it out, but we still knew our parts.
"I'm so glad to see nothing changes,"
Gabriel muttered, giving his son the side eye. Unfazed, Connor tucked his hands into his pockets.
"I only wear leather for the really formal events."
"We'll have to make this fancier for you next time," I said with a sugary smile.
"How were things in Paris?" Tanya asked, interrupting the byplay. "We heard about the attack near the Eiffel Tower yesterday."
"It was harrowing," I said.
"You were involved?"
Connor asked, brows lifted. The vampires attacked humans, and I was closer than many of the guards.
She jumped down from the second level of the Eiffel Tower to join the fight,
Gabriel said with a smile that held a surprising amount of wolfish approval.
I'm surprised you didn't hear about it.
I hadn't, Connor said, and I liked the narrowed consideration in his eyes. I didn't need his approval, but I liked the idea of shaking him up.
Here comes trouble, Gabriel said, but he looked amused at the man who walked toward us.
He was a lot of man, nearly 7 inches over 6 feet, and all of it hard-packed muscle. His skin was tan, his hair dark brown and shagging to his shoulders, his eyes hauntingly pale blue, and they crinkled at the corners when he smiled. They were topped with eyebrows that formed almost perfect V's above his eyes.
Elisa Sullivan, he said, as I live and breathe.
Riley Sixkiller was a member of the NAC pack, and he was Lulu's ex-boyfriend. While I was limited to nighttime tutors, Lulu had gone to high school with a good number of the NAC pack, who lived in Ukrainian Village, not far from her parents' home in Wicker Park. She and Riley had dated for nearly a year. She was the weird and artsy girl. He was the athlete. They were from very different worlds, but had been inseparable for a time. They'd broken up because it had been too hard for her to date a supernatural. Lulu had still been wrestling with her own demons, trying to come to terms with the magic she'd decided not to use, but still had to live with. Riley and I had stayed friends afterward. I let him embrace me, and was swamped by memories from the patchouli and sandalwood that clung to his clothes. He still smelled the same.
You've grown up, Riley said, winging up his eyebrows. Paris was good to you.
It didn't suck. How are you? Been keeping the pack in line? Riley snorted.
They don't need me for that.
He gave Connor a considering look.
He's the one with his finger on the pulse, usually of the hottest girl in the room.
Riley wasn't wrong. I was half surprised Connor wasn't here with a date. A gong sounded, and we looked toward the dais at the end of the ballroom. Jessamine Franklin, the city's two-term mayor, stepped up to the microphone. She was a tall and athletic woman, with dark skin and straight dark hair that just reached her shoulders and curved around her face. Her smile was wide and bright, her eyes sharp and canny. She wore a red sheath dress with an angular bodice that zigged across her shoulders, and her signature stiletto pumps.
Welcome, she said, casting her gaze across the room. Welcome, and once again, welcome. Welcome to Chicago. Welcome to this celebration of the diversity of our supernatural brethren, and welcome to this opportunity. For the past 2 decades, Chicago has experienced peace between humans and supernaturals. Vampires, shifters, humans, nymphs, fairies, and more have lived side by side. They have worked side by side. They have lived and loved side by side. That was not by chance, but by design. Because Chicago's humans and supernaturals saw past their own fears and concerns and looked to the future, to the needs of their children and their children's children, in order to make a city for all of us. The opportunity is here. The time is now. Let us act.
She stepped back from the podium, and the room lit into applause.
God, I love her,
Theo murmured, voice soaked with adoration.
She is an impressive woman,
my father agreed, and lifted his glass to the mayor. She left the dais, waving as she was escorted through the crowd. At the edge, she shook hands with a pale man with perfectly arranged silver hair, his suit a gray of nearly the same shade, with gleaming silver cufflinks, a knotted tie of pale blue silk, and a pocket square of the same shade that was folded to a nearly deadly-looking point. He put an arm on hers and made a show of guiding her through the ballroom. This was William Dearborn, the Ombudsman. I didn't have any particular reason to dislike him or what he'd done with my great-grandfather's office, but there was something too slick about his look, about his mannerisms, that I didn't care for. A lot of showmanship, and that made me wonder how much substance lay beneath it. The gong sounded again, and the overhead lights darkened, and colored lights danced across the runway. The crowd gasped as a sleek black panther trotted down the aisle. It was enormous, 5 feet of gleaming fur over taut muscle, tail flicking as it moved sinuously toward the dais. I pulled out my screen and pointed it, recording video as the panther stalked away. Since Sari would be in the parade, she wouldn't be able to see the other delegates, so I'd promised I'd get video. The big cat reached the end of the runway, hopped onto the dais, and circled back to face the crowd. The spotlights flashed, the air in the room electrifying as magic began to spin around the animal, creating a funnel of power as thick as fog that sparked like lightning and sent the tingle of power through the room. Lights flared again, then faded, revealing the stunning woman who'd been a predator only moments before. Her skin was pale, her eyes wide and blue, her hair a gleaming golden fall across her shoulders. She was utterly naked, revealing a body that was both toned and curvy in all the right places. More gasps as the woman stood proudly, aware and unfazed by her nakedness, then inclined her head. The applause was deafening, the guests impressed by the magic, the panther, or the woman it had shifted into. She walked off the dais, where Connor waited. I hadn't even seen him slip around to the front. An assistant helped the woman slip into a silk kimono, while she gave Connor a feline smile that suggested they were more than just packmates. I guessed he was here with a date after all. It figured. She was exactly his type. Drop-dead gorgeous and entirely aware of it. I'd seen at least a dozen of his girlfriends, and they'd all been the gorgeous and hard-partying variety. Not unexpected for shifters, given the culture had a lot in common with a 1990s hair metal video.
"Wow," Theo murmured. "That was... and she is..." "That's Tabby," Gabriel said. "Your first time seeing the shift?"
"Second,"
Theo said.
"But the first time wasn't nearly so... beautiful."
Gabriel chuckled knowingly.
"Shifters do know how to make an entrance," my mother said, and lifted her glass to Gabriel.
"Well played."
"Just a reminder of our existence," he said, "in case any of these fine, fanged people forget."
They weren't likely to forget this. The show had started with a bang, and that was only the beginning. The international guests came first, groups of vampires who carried the standards of their houses and nations. Spain, Germany, Ireland, Denmark, and a dozen more, most dressed like businessmen and women in suits and heels. I gave Scotland the prize for best costume, as their male vampires wore full Highland regalia while letting their fangs show. Iceland won my prize for innovation. They all wore hand-knitted sweaters patterned with blood droplets, crescent moons, and katanas. The French delegation wore white and carried small French flags. There were no croissants, but they wore berets that looked better on the vampires than they probably ever had on humans. And then it was time for Chicago's supernaturals. The river troll who'd stowed his pipe brought his enormous friends, and they walked down the aisle with a heavy, loping stride. They were followed by the river nymphs, small and voluptuous women with flowing hair, who used the aisle like a catwalk in their snug and tiny dresses. Words turned to whispers as the ballroom doors opened again, and the fairies made their entrance. Claudia, their leader, looked very much the part of a fairy queen. Pale skin and wavy, strawberry blonde hair, a body that was tall and lush and curvy. She wore a straight, sleeveless gown the color of candlelight and nearly translucent. Over it was a wide neck piece of hammered bronze and gleaming cabochon jewels. Her dress was jeweled, too, with arcs of sapphire and citron and quartz that glittered in the spotlights. Her hair was knotted in complicated braids that spilled across her shoulders. Her magic was old, the cold vibration of power more like a slow, thick undulation. I didn't know her companion, a tall fairy with dark, straight hair that reached his shoulders. His face was slender, his chin square, and his brows thick above dark eyes. There was something young and yet severe about his face, or maybe it was the hard look in his eyes. His body was lean and fit. He'd skipped the tuxedo, instead opting for a long, ivory tunic that draped past his hips, in the same candlelight tone as Claudia's, and dotted with the same jewels, if less ornately than hers. So he was here to compliment her, not compete. Her consort, not her king. She was to be the queen and the showstopper. He looked perfectly happy about the arrangement. They murmured as they strode down the runway, heads held high, as if oblivious to everyone else in the room. Behind them strode a dozen of the fairies who'd once guarded Cadogan House, at least until they'd betrayed my father, turning their weapons against us because Claudia had changed her mind. They also wore tunics tonight instead of their usual black fatigues. There'd once been thousands of fairies in England, Scotland, Ireland, and Wales, at least until humans exterminated some and extradited the rest. The fairies who'd survived the transition had lived together in a magicked tower in Chicago's Potter Park, which had insulated them from time, as fairies weren't immortal, and from the distance from their homeland. But the protective magic had diminished with time, so much that Claudia could barely leave her tower. At least until Sorcha had inadvertently given the fairies a much-needed jolt. Sorcha was the evil sorceress who destroyed my grandfather's building. She was a beautiful and wealthy woman who'd hidden her magic and then used it to make a bid to take over the city. Her first defeat at Towerline created a lot of powerful emotions in Chicago. Unwilling to accept her defeat, she figured out how to gather up those emotions, spark that collection with magic, and create a new being. That creature was the egregore. Then she'd made the egregore physically manifest, putting it into the form of a dragon that my parents later defeated. Using a spell created by Lulu's mother, the egregore's magic was bound into my mother's sword, the power imprisoned in the blade. The spell inadvertently bound me, then only a tiny nub of life, to my mother. Sorcha's alchemy had been complicated, and one of its side effects was a wash of magic over the city while she gathered up all those emotions. Sups who were already healthy, like vampires and shifters, noticed the magic but hadn't been physically affected by it. But it had given fairies an obvious boost. They looked younger and stronger, they'd been able to have children, and they'd become more public because they had the strength to leave the tower. They'd abandoned their narrow tower for a home they'd built along the Chicago River, an enormous stone building modeled after England's Bodiam Castle. I'd even seen Claudia naked and strategically positioned on the cover of Vogue. But they looked older now, too, as if the last few years had done damage. Maybe they were beginning to age again, or maybe the cover shot had been airbrushed, and we were seeing the fairies tonight in their true and honest skin. I was watching Claudia when her companion turned his head and met my gaze. Magic rose, cold and heavy as iron. Magic that pulled and enticed, because that was the nature of fairy power. The reason why fairy tales always mentioned hapless villagers being lured away into the woods or across the moors. Fairies had drawn them near. But for all that power, I had the distinct impression he wasn't looking at me, but through me, as if he could see past skin and bone and vampire to the magic that lurked there. I didn't want anyone, much less an enemy of Cadogan House, seeing that. There was a sharp burst of magic, a slice of power, and the man's gaze slid back to the runway in front of him. Claudia, I guessed, hadn't liked his dawdling, and she'd snapped him back into line. And then they continued down the runway and disappeared into the crowd. "Do you know them?" I asked Theo when they were gone and the magic had dissipated. "The fairies?" Theo shook his head.
"I've seen them at events, but haven't talked to them. They tend to stick with other fairies. Whatever her hierarchy, and you can bet she has one, humans aren't even close to the top. They're fascinating, though, aren't they? It's easy to understand how people were lost to the Greenland."
The Greenland was the fairies' ancestral home. "Yeah," I said, and crossed my arms, still feeling the chill from the fairies' magic, and not sad they'd moved away. My grandparents were wealthy socialites. My parents were diplomatic and well-connected. Because of that, I'd been to plenty of parties over the years, and I usually enjoyed them. I liked the food, the chatting, the people watching. But it had been a long night. Jet lag was giving me a headache, and my brain was getting logy. I watched Sari and Marion for some sign that they were slowing down, and hoped the party wouldn't go until dawn. One more glass of golden champagne, and I'd slump a little too far toward relaxed, so I switched to caffeine. There was a lonely silver tureen on a buffet table along the wall, so I flipped the spout and let coffee spill into a paper cup, added a splash of milk and sugar. And I turned to find Claudia's companion standing beside me. I barely managed not to jerk and spill scalding liquid across my hand. He stood, tall and lean, in a puddle of magic that spilled around our feet like fog, invisible but tangible.
"I am Ruadon."
"Elisa," I said.
"You are interesting," he said. "Unique among vampires."
"Not so interesting."
"Oh, I would disagree. You are the first bloodletter born of blood, not merely transformed by it. The first bloodletter who was never human."
Calling us bloodletters was derogatory, but not a surprise. It was the term that fairies used to describe vampires. And if a human had said I'd never been human, they'd likely have meant it as an insult. But his voice held curiosity and interest. "I am a vampire," I confirmed. He looked me over again, and again I didn't care for the feeling. "And you're Claudia's companion?" I asked, voice flat.
"We do not subscribe to human notions of romantic companionship. I am her consort, if she wills it."
I had the sense he didn't want to discuss it. Nevertheless, I persisted. "And does she will it?"
"I am honored to have been chosen for several cycles."
His eyes flashed.
"But that does not concern you, bloodletter."
"And what does concern me? You sought me out."
I am curious about your biology, about how you managed to cling to this plane when all others before you failed.
I presumed he meant the fact that I'd been born, which hadn't been up to me. But most people didn't know the entire story, how my mother's biology had been enhanced by a binding spell created by Lulu's mother, Mallory. My parents had explained it to me when I'd been old enough to wonder why I didn't have any other vampire children to play with. For everyone else, there was speculation that I was an adopted human, or played by a very well-paid actress, or part of a vampire medical conspiracy to create a new race of super-beings. A fang in every bassinet, which would have been nice, because I'd have had more kids to play with. It wasn't up to me, I said, not interested in sharing the details with a stranger. Ruadon didn't look convinced by the answer.
We were both of us born in an age of magic.
Were we?
We made ourselves.
Now I was just lost.
Ruadon!
The word was sharp, a warning delivered by someone behind me. I glanced back and found Riley, arms crossed and brows lifted, a flat expression on his face for the fairy.
What do you want?
Ruadon asked through clenched teeth, disgust plain in his eyes. He did not like shifters.
I need to speak with Ms. Sullivan, Riley said.
Ruadon's mouth thinned into a line, but he maintained control, inclined his head, then looked at me.
Bloodletter, he said, the word like a vicious promise, then strode away. That guy is creepy as fuck, Riley said quietly when he was gone.
He's a weird one, I agreed.
What's his deal?
He asked me about being born. As a vampire, I mean.
He's looking to date a vampire? I thought he was with Claudia.
So did I, which made it weirder. I smiled up at him. Thanks for the interruption.
You're welcome. I'd never say you needed rescuing, but figured I could do you a solid. I owe you one since I never made it to Paris to visit.
You owe me a big one, I said with a grin. I accept Leo's gift cards and auto credits. He patted down his suit.
I don't have either of those.
He reached into his pocket, pulled out an old-fashioned butterscotch candy, offered it.
I don't know how long this has been in there, but you can have it.
I'm not even a little bit tempted.
Yeah, that's probably a good call. He grinned. This is a borrowed suit.
I narrowed my gaze at him. Were you going to tell me that before or after I ate it? His smile was slow and lazy.
Probably after.
After a careful glance around, he dropped the candy into a potted plant. Typical Riley.
I played a type. You gonna be in town long enough to get in a game night?
I grinned. I don't know about my schedule, but I wouldn't mind taking a little of your money. He winked.
Then it's done. And it'll irritate Connor, so that's a bonus.
I patted his arm. Find your joy, Riley. Find your joy.
It was a beautiful party, Sari said, strappy sandals dangling from a finger, a champagne flute in her other hand, as we rode the elevator back to the top of the Portman Grand. I'd seen Marion up to her room an hour ago, after asking Theo to keep an eye on Sari, and was glad for the break. There'd been a lot of supernaturals crammed into the ballroom, a lot of magic swimming around, and the effect was dizzying. It was like a crowded party with too much perfume, except the perfumes were all deadly. And then there was Ruadon, who hadn't confronted me again, but whom I'd stayed uncomfortably aware of. But considering the excellent champagne, meeting a new friend in Theo, and catching up with my family,
All in all, it had been a pretty good party. Chicago cleans up well, I agreed, and nobody punched anyone. Sari snorted, then covered her mouth delicately.
I believe I may be a little too relaxed.
Jet lag and champagne, I said as the elevator came to a smooth stop, are a powerful combination.
Oui, she said, and we stepped onto her floor.
She hummed La Vie en Rose as we walked toward her door, then made a grand bow.
Breakfast, she said, unlocking the door with her thumbprint. Marion would like to speak to us at dusk, before the session begins.
Tomorrow was only a partial night of talks, a 3-hour session to allow for opening statements and the beginning of discussions. Long enough to get people talking, but not so long that the frustrations they'd brought with them would boil over. They'd get to business in the second session, working with the host vampires and others from around the world to come up with a plan forward. Hopefully. My parents were hosting an event at Cadogan House after the first session, another party intended to keep the atmosphere social and productive. And there'd almost certainly be great food and more champagne. I was going to have to pace myself.
Sure, I said. I'll be here at dusk.
Bonne nuit, she said, and closed the door again. I walked back to my room, sending Lulu another message as I traversed the wide hallway. Day one complete. Time to talk tomorrow? Her answer was nearly instantaneous.
Girl, yes. Come to Little Red.
I promised I would, then fell into bed without another thought. 5. When the sun set again, I dressed in a black suit, added heel boots and my katana, and headed down to Marion's room for breakfast. Her suite was practically a palace. The living room was enormous and faced the river, with boxy leather couches that didn't interrupt the view. One wall was a window over Chicago, the city's lights piercing through the darkness like pinpricks. It looked magical. But darkness covered a lot of flaws. That is, I thought, one of the reasons why vampires tend to be overly focused on politics and strategy. It was easy to ignore the problems of the communities humans had built when we literally didn't see them. I was vetted by the guards who flanked the door, which Sari opened when they allowed me to knock.
Good evening, she said,
looking perfect in a sheath dress with an angular neck and heeled boots.
Thanks for sending me the video. I haven't yet watched it, but look forward to it.
She gestured to the dining room table that stretched across another bank of windows in the adjoining room. The table was decked with platters of pastries and pitchers of blood, and the scent of bacon filled the air.
Marion has assembled a feast for us, she said.
Looks like it.
Good evening, Elisa.
Marion moved closer from the bank of windows and offered a hand. Her skin was dark, her hair cropped into short curls, her eyes piercingly intelligent. Tonight she wore a simply cut black suit with block heels, and pearls dotted her ears. Magic followed as she moved, putting a cinnamon-sharp bite into the air. It tangled with the magic of apprehensive vampires, gave it a bright but comforting edge.
Good evening, Marion.
You look very competent today.
From any other vampire, that might have been an insult. But Marion wasn't one for sarcasm. She was a straightforward woman who appreciated critical thinking and a strong work ethic, and she was well-loved and respected by her vampires.
Thank you. Any news from Paris?
The day passed peacefully, and I am grateful. Given the masters who create the violence are here in the city of your birth, I hope we have not passed our problems on to you.
I hope so too, but even if so, Chicago is skilled at handling ornery supernaturals.
A corner of her mouth lifted into a careful and conservative smile.
So it seems.
She gestured to the dining room.
Shall we break our fast?
Odette and the rest of the vampires were already in the large dining room, sipping coffee at the table or putting plump fruit onto trays. I took a croissant and poured myself some coffee, added cream and sugar, and took a seat beside Sari. When all the vampires had assembled their breakfasts, Marion tapped her water glass. The vampires turned their heads toward her in syncopation, like birds changing direction.
Good evening, she said when she had their attention. Her voice was soft and smoky, like a torch singer from another era. I wanted us to have an opportunity to commune before the event.
She looked at us, then at the city silhouetted through the window, the blinking top of the Willis Tower, shining red for the occasion.
Much trouble has been made to assemble us here. Cost, time, compromise. But we are an old people, and we are stubborn. We fear change, and we fear those different from us, even as we seek to live among them. But there is opportunity here.
She looked at me, nodded approvingly.
There is a chance to make a new way in Paris, in France, in Europe, in the world, to find the same peace that they found in Chicago. There is a chance for cooperation, even if we can't move past our own self-interest, our own prejudices. So, let us take a moment of silence to prepare ourselves for negotiation and debate and finding the path forward.
She nodded, and a hush fell across the room. And in that quiet, hope rose. The Sanford had been a theater with Baroque style, vaulted ceilings, a golden dome, murals, and velvet drapes. It fell into disrepair, and was later saved by a very smart woman who realized that even if Chicago didn't need another theater, there were never enough wedding venues. She stripped out the chairs and the middle balconies, cleaned up the paint and gilt, and turned the main floor into the city's grandest ballroom. Tonight, crystal chandeliers put a golden glow across the room, which was swagged with the banners of each vampire house participating in the talks. Tables had been politically arranged on the main floor, with a long, oval table in the middle, each seat marked with a placard. Behind it, another U of tables had been lifted by risers, so the delegates seated there had a clear view of the proceedings, or because those in the back row had complained their seats weren't good enough. The energy in the air was enough to ramp up my adrenaline. This was an important night. We'd gone through two security checks to get into the building, and the theater itself also had security. Guards stood at intervals along the wall, some who'd been brought by the delegates as security or escorts, and others who'd volunteered from Chicago's houses and the pack. Dearborn wasn't here tonight, probably because there wasn't a photo opportunity. Cameras weren't allowed inside, and the mayor wouldn't attend the talks, so he'd probably moved on to greener pastures. I didn't recognize many of the vampires or shifters, but found Connor on the opposite side of the room. He wore a black suit tonight that was perfectly cut to showcase his broad shoulders, narrow waist. Connor and I might not have had much in common, but I could admit he cut a powerful figure. It was the first time I'd seen him looking so serious and focused. While his posture said he was relaxed, shoulders back, hands in his pockets, there was no mistaking that careful attention in his eyes as his gaze slowly slid across the room, back and forth, looking for threats. He had grown up, and I was having trouble reconciling that with the cocky child who'd stolen my toy sword. Connor's gaze lifted, met mine, and held. And there was as much power in the look as there was in his physical presence. There was strength in his gaze, like it had its own mass, its own weight. It was intense.